One of the things that's changed a lot since the earlier months of the pandemic is that very few people are making predictions anymore. And that's because, well, most predictions that were specific were wrong. And the reason that they were wrong is that the virus is evolving faster than scientists expected. Evolutionary biology does have something to say about that, not about what'll happen next exactly, but about what could happen, what's happened before in other pandemics, and which scenarios are more likely to unfold. That's what's in store for today's episode of Follow the Science. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of a fellowship from the Society for Professional Journalists. So today I'm talking with evolutionary biologist Andrew Reed. He's from Penn State University, and he's someone I've interviewed many times before when I wrote columns about evolution for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His specialty is the evolution of pathogens and their hosts, that is, how our diseases drive our evolution and how we drive theirs. So today we're going to talk about whether humans are collecting more and more endemic viruses in our increasingly interconnected world. We'll talk about an incident where humans launched germ warfare, an attack against rabbits in Australia, and what scientists learned from the way the rabbits and the viruses attacking them evolved. We'll talk about what measures we should continue to take against SARS-CoV-2, and finally, we'll talk about how the virus might evolve in the future.
Something like measles probably couldn't persist in hunter-gatherer communities. And when you get the agriculture and the buildup of more larger, more stable populations, and you can get these things spilling over from wildlife into populations that can sustain them, then you get that. And that's why I feel so much concern going forward, that people think of something like SARS-CoV-2 as being special, a once in 100 years event. But the conditions that create these things are getting more and more prominent, right? We've never had this many humans on the planet, and we've never had so much connectivity. So, you know, previously HIV could have spilled over into humans for an awful long time, but the 20th century gave it the conditions to get out of those villages and into the whole world. And nothing's changed. In fact, it's got, you know, more people, more movement, and actually a lot more stress on the animal populations that contain a lot of these potential spillover risks. So to me, I think there's good evidence that the number of spillover events is going up through time. And it just seems to me that there's nothing changing and those conditions are getting more and more problematic. So we are likely to have more and more spillover events.
Do you think that humans are accumulating viruses, endemic viruses then, because we are in this higher than ever population, more connected than ever, people flying halfway around the world routinely? Are we accumulating endemic viruses and are we going to accumulate more?
It has to be true. We've only lost one, right? Smallpox, with a huge amount of effort. And in the time since we knocked out smallpox, we've gained several, right? Now, nobody had heard about HIV by definition at that time when the smallpox got eradicated. And then you just think about the ones that we talk about now, you know, chikungunya, Zika, MERS, SARS-1, SARS-2, all of those, you know, we either knew them, but not as any sort of threat, or they're completely novel. And so I think what you find in a textbook or a microbiology class now is radically different from what you did when I was a student.
Exactly. So that gets to this very interesting paper you sent on what looks like it was biological warfare against rabbits.
That's right. So the story there is that the myxomatosis virus was introduced into the Australian rabbit population. So the Australian rabbits are a European rabbit that was introduced into Australia for the fur trade. And those rabbits did what rabbits do. They bred like rabbits and took over the country in vast numbers to the destruction of much farmland. And so the Australians were looking at solutions, trying to do control measures on these rabbits. And one of them was myxomatosis virus. And that has been a triumph of success from the biocontrol point of view. It's when it first spilled over into the rabbit population in Australia, it killed tens of millions of rabbits in 6 months, possibly 100 million rabbits in 6 months, the biggest, most devastating outbreak of a virus for any vertebrate that we know of. Most hosts that died in the shortest space of time over a very, very large part of Southeast Australia. And then the virus was extremely virulent when it spilled over. It killed 99.9% of rabbits.
So this thing happened and the rabbits were devastated, but there are still rabbits in Australia today because that tiny fraction that survived partially rebounded, and that gave scientists a chance to study the way that host species and viruses affect each other's evolution.
Thanks to some very fine work by Frank Fenner at the time, he started putting the viruses from the field into laboratory rabbits and so could measure the lethality through time. And not surprisingly, something that starts off that lethal, a virus variants that were able to kill fewer rabbits, or at least kill them in a longer time, over a longer time period, they had a transmission advantage. But like we see with, you know, the subsequent evolution of SARS-CoV-2, we get different variants, and the variants that popped up in myxomatosis were less virulent to start with. That said, they were still killing 40-50% of rabbits, but they typically did it over a longer period.
It looks like I misspoke here. He said that the virus killed off 99.9% of the rabbits, not just 99%. So there would actually be only 0.1% left, not 1%. And this was, now how do you, so the rabbits, that the 1% that survived would have had some resistance, I take it. So was there a way to tell whether the virus was getting less virulent or the rabbits were just getting more resistant?
That was the beauty of the work that Fenner started. So he took virus from the field and put it into standard laboratory rabbits and looked at the change through time and what the field viruses did to the laboratory rabbits. And then he did the reverse. He took the original ancestral strain of the virus and stuck it into the rabbits that he caught from the field through time. And so that is something we just so don't have with human diseases. We have no what we in the business call common garden, where we can compare like for like. So it's very hard to know what's happening to the evolution of virulence in SARS-CoV-2, but it was very easy to study it in the myxomatosis case because you've got a lab animal. And so the virulence went down to start with, and then over the subsequent decade or two, it sort of stabilized with variants, ongoing evolution, but all the variants that dominated had this sort of intermediate level of virulence killing in
and,
the order
okay,
of
okay, so just at this point, I take it that the rabbits, when they went down to 1% of their population, that they started to rebound.
That's right.
So when he's doing these experiments, have the rabbits started to rebound from this 1% of survivors? So, and from that, there you have a virus that's a little less virulent and rabbits that have some resistance as at the same time. And then once they expand, you're getting a big population, a bigger population of rabbits that at least can survive long enough to reproduce, even though this virus is still endemic.
That's absolutely correct. So that very few rabbits that survived the infections to start with, those ones had some sort of innate resistance. And then, of course, as the virus becomes less virulent, more and more rabbits are surviving, but particularly the ones that have innate resistance. So you get the spread of innate resistance in the rabbit population. And Fenner's work showed beautifully that what was going on was an increased resistance in the rabbit population. And we now know that a lot of that was to do with the initial innate response. When the virus first gets into the rabbit, they handled it better. They were able to suppress virus replication more readily from the outset.
To understand what happens next, you have to look at the two major components of the immune system, the innate and adaptive immune systems. So the innate immune system is that first line of defense, the part that sometimes fights off an infection before you really get sick. And the adaptive immune system is the part that uses antibodies and immune cells, those B cells and T cells, to fight a specific virus or another pathogen. And it's the adaptive part that becomes activated or put on the ready by a vaccine or a previous infection. We know that our pandemic coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, has mutated to at least partly get around that adaptive immunity from our past infections and vaccines. And it turns out that other viruses have been able to evolve in a way that interferes with innate immunity. That's actually what happened with that myxomatosis virus in the rabbits. Just right. So the so-called innate immune system, as opposed to the antibodies, which are the adaptive immune system and the T cells and all the right.
And it was really that response right at the very beginning of the infection that the rabbits got better at. And then over time, what we found with the isolates that we took from Australia in the 1990s, well, at least we analyzed the ones taken in the 1990s just recently. And what we found was that those viruses had evolved the ability to suppress that innate response. So there are genes in the virus that do a better job of turning down that innate response. And it's so they're so good at it that if you put them into a laboratory rabbit, so one that's never seen the virus, population that's never seen the virus before, the rabbits don't die of myxomatosis. They die of uncontrolled bacteria. They can't control their own bacteria.
Wow, it's like having AIDS.
Yes, except super acute. So they die within 10 to 14 days and from overwhelming bacteremia usually. And that's because they are completely failing to mount a response that contains their own bacteria. In fact, the viruses in the laboratory rabbits, the 1990s viruses are actually as lethal or more lethal than the one that was released in 1950, but they are causing the lethality in a very different way. They're causing it by this immunosuppression, massive immunosuppression.
And what happens to the rabbits out in the field? Are they a little better at handling it? Do they sometimes die of it? Or how does it affect them?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that in the field, what you see is pretty much what you saw in the 1950s. So rabbits get very sick. Many of them die. They get the typical myxomatosis lesions. So this arms race between the rabbit becoming more resistant, the virus becoming more virulent has sort of led to no change. It's kind of like the classic duck paddling hard on the river. You know, there's a lot of action going on underneath it all with the viral and the rabbit genes evolving rapidly. But on the surface, there's come some sort of stasis. And you can only pull that apart by doing the experiments where you take these modern viruses and stick them in lab rabbits and compare that to taking the 1950s viruses and sticking them in lab rabbits. And that's how we can see these differences.
Wow. So the rabbit population in Australia is stable.
It rebounded from the catastrophe, the initial catastrophe. So those initial maybe 100 million rabbits, nothing like it, never returned to that level again. But it is higher than it was in the early 1950s. So it's gone. There's been some recovery and sufficient recovery that the Australians have tried a release of a different virus, a Khaleesi virus, and that has also had biocontrol effects of knocking back the populations. And that virus also seems to be in an arms race with the host. So that virus looks like it's getting more virulent, but it looks like the rabbits are getting more resistant to it. So it looks like we've got a replay of that story happening with a second virus.
Now, you know, from my perspective, this all sounds very dangerous and the kind of thing that humans might do with good intentions, but did we get lucky that this virus didn't mutate and go into lots of other species and become an ecological disaster? It just sounds unbelievably dangerous to do this, especially knowing now that viruses evolve.
So as a microbiologist, I say this particular virus, this particular group of viruses, pox viruses, this is one of, those are very host specific. So species jumps are rare. And the virus itself came from a rabbit in a different genus from South America where it's very avirulent. And so at the time in the 1940s, 30s and 40s, when they were talking of doing this, there was a lot of controversy about whether this virus might do what you're talking about, jump from rabbits to other species, including humans. And actually some of the folk involved at that time infected themselves deliberately with the myxomatosis virus in order to show that it was not going to infect humans.
Oh my God, that's quite a story.
Those folk did a very good job of documenting what they were doing at the time. And it was not without controversy when it happened. And you could say that knowing what we know now, obviously one of the things we're seeing with SARS-CoV-2 perhaps is the evolution of broader host range. And that could have happened here. But as I say, these pox viruses are typically very host specific. That's why we're able to get rid of smallpox, right? It's just a human virus. And so it's not like SARS-CoV-2, which is jumping into lots of things and bouncing backwards and forwards. Coronaviruses are very promiscuous in the hosts, and they're really happy jumping around. And other types of virus, including the pox viruses, don't do these sorts of jumps. Why that is a very, very interesting and unsolved question.
Yeah, it's very unnerving. And one of the interviews in my last podcast, right, we talked about the fact that this SARS-CoV-2 has gone to so many different species and spread among them, including our house pets and zoo animals. It seems like it's going to be very impossible to eradicate this virus.
I think even if it wasn't in other species, if it was only in humans, it would also be impossible to eradicate, especially with the current tools we have. We haven't got,
because the vaccines don't give you complete immunity.
The only reason we got smallpox is because we got fantastic herd immunity, and you need very significant levels of transmission blocking immunity to get that. And we don't have that at the moment. So maybe next generation vaccines will do a better job of preventing transmission. But until we have that, the whole notion of herd immunity in SARS-CoV-2 is just for transmission, for maintenance of the parasite, of the virus. It's no longer a relevant concept. And I just want to emphasize, because, you know, I have to, these vaccines are still extremely good at preventing serious disease.
Yes, I know. And I will emphasize that as well, that people should get vaccinated because it's the right thing to do for them, for their communities. We can no longer tell people that if you get vaccinated, you'll contribute to eradicating the virus through herd immunity, that we know that's not going to happen, at least with these vaccines. But there's still so many other good reasons to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the principal reasons in my head are that it protects you yourself from getting seriously sick. And there are people that depend on you. And so you should be doing that just for that reason alone. But I also think when our community hospital was no longer taking ambulances because of all the sick COVID cases in there, you should do it for the community so the rest of us can be treated in our hospitals at times of a high COVID density.
The next thing I ask him is whether viruses do tend to become milder over time. And the answer is, well, sometimes and sometimes not. And as we learned from the incident with the myxomatosis virus in the rabbits, sometimes the viruses get worse.
I think it could go either way. The one that worries me most is if we get the suppression of responses that are elicited by past infection or by vaccination. That's kind of a scary prospect, right? And so we wouldn't want the protective immunity turned down by the virus. And viruses are well capable of doing these things. It's really a question of whether SARS-CoV-2 can do it as well. And there is some discussion about one of the proteins that's under some mutational pressure being better at and turning down innate responses. You know, we hope that it doesn't start to get as good at immunosuppressing folk as the myxomatosis virus is capable of suppressing rabbits. That's most scary prospect to me. You know, I think we can deal with mutations in the spike protein that cause variants that might need some adjustments to the vaccination. That sort of antigenic escape is like we see in flu, seasonal flu. You know, we can deal with that. The one that worries me more is whether you can get variants that could turn down responses. And, you know, many viruses have very good mechanisms for redirecting immune responses in ways that allow it to thrive, turning down responses, putting out antigenic noise that distracts the protective responses onto the wrong antigens. You know, there are lots of ways pathogens have got of getting around our immune responses. And, you know, in a sense, that's why so many of them persist and do so well.
Oh, antigenic noise. That's interesting. So sort of like putting out a lot of decoys so that your immune system gets overwhelmed fighting other stuff.
Yeah, that's well known. It's kind of like throwing the chaff out of the back of a bomber and getting the radar to focus on the guided missiles to focus on all the garbage coming out of the bomber rather than on the bomber. Whether this virus can do that is not clear, I think, at the moment. But if you look at the long list of tricks that viruses have to evade immunity, there is a lot of scope, way, way beyond simply changing the shape of the spike protein.
I mean, it's sort of interesting, the case of the rabbits that we're looking at, you know, what's a short time scale for us humans, but must be quite a few generations for rabbits. And so you're actually seeing something that wouldn't happen to human evolution for, I don't know, 10 times that amount of time or longer, probably 20 or 30 times that amount of time.
Yeah, I'm not expecting that from a point of view of public health, we need to worry about the evolutionary arms race between humans and the virus. You know, human genomes are going to change so slowly relative to the virus. That sort of coevolution is irrelevant. What is relevant is the conditions that the virus is finding itself in is changing all the time because of the way in which people now are, many people are vaccinated, many people have had, you know, Delta and Omicron and other things, some people two or three times. So the immune landscape that the virus is seeing now is radically different from what it was a year ago. And I expect in another year, it's going to be radically different again. And so that's the current arms race we really have. It's between the sort of vaccines and vaccine manufacturers and the different approaches and the ongoing evolution of the virus. And if you look in, for example, coronaviruses in the agricultural setting, particularly in poultry, you see that lots of new vaccines needed, different places and different times, different variants in different places and different times. The threat from the viruses comes and goes. And so it's a very dynamical picture. And, you know, it's hard not to think that's the zone we're now into with the SARS-CoV-2, given, you know, the variants we're seeing and the ongoing evolution we're seeing, and the fact that we can't block transmission with our vaccines.
So, you know, I had another question, and this is something I've been thinking about since, you know, the first wave sort of came down, and then the second wave went up and then came down, and then we had the Delta wave and the Omicron wave. We might have a BA2 wave, or we might not. That it seems like it's still a little unclear what's causing the waves to go down when they go down. And I wondered if it also, it may have something to do with the variability of our immunity, our genetic predisposition to getting infected, and whether the different variants maybe are better at infecting different hosts. So those who somehow were pretty resistant to the first one were less resistant to Delta, and then people that were pretty resistant to those were not resistant to Omicron, whether each of these new iterations of the virus might somehow be better adapted to, you know, finding the people that were resistant to the earlier ones.
Yeah, well, first let me say that I completely agree with you that it's not clear why these waves go down. And there's a lot of hand waving and storytelling going on. But actually, at a deep level, I don't think we know what causes them to go down and why they go down at the rate they do and down in some places and not others. That, I think, has been a big the hand waves are quite compelling. You know, we all got immune, and so they go down. The hand waves can be quite compelling. But I actually think at a deep level, we don't know quantitatively why these things are going down. And even in our own setting in the university, when we had the first wave, around about the second month of the semester, it turned over and went down. And we have no idea why, even though there were tons and tons of students still on campus that hadn't seen it. And, you know, people were taking credit for it. It's our mask mandate. It's our what we did in terms of the borough, this, that, and the other thing, and police. Maybe it was immunity. Maybe it was something else. Shouldn't we figure that out? Because it, whatever it was, worked. And we should understand that so we can do it again.
It's the secret sauce. Exactly.
It's the secret sauce. And it's just happened right now with Omicron, right?
Yes.
At least in our local area. It just vanished.
Oh, in our area. Yeah, I mean, and I still can't quite get a straight answer. I live in Rhode Island. That we had the largest peak of any state in the country. Some of that might be statistical fluctuations because we're so small. But we had I think, more than 500 per 100,000 cases at some point that was, I don't know, 30% higher than the next worst state, like a lot worse.
Yeah, I haven't yet seen any analysis to show that quantitatively based on data that something like that went down because of Omicron immunity. You know, there was enough people infected with Omicron to generate enough immunity that, especially given that the transmission still seems to be very high despite having seen Omicron, I do think it's a very, very big gap in our understanding. But to go back to your other question about whether it's host, what we would call host heterogeneity, that there's differences in people. Yeah, I think the biggest source of the heterogeneity is not going to turn out to be anything to do with human genetics, at least not directly. It's to do with previous exposure. So some populations are very well vaccinated. Some populations have seen a lot of disease, natural infections, and so they have immunity to that. Some of them have seen a lot of Delta. Some of them, you know, that sort of heterogeneity is kicking in now. And there are obviously people that have seen, you know, some people have had Omicron twice on top of their boosts. And so the heterogeneity that's going to be very substantial, I think, going forward is that sort of heterogeneity, previous exposure history.
And now we move on to what's coming with the pandemic. And people are no longer making those specific predictions, but we do know evolutionary biologists can at least give us some possibilities. They can tell us what might be coming next.
Omicron came out of nowhere, and it showed us that you can get a very different virus, both at spike and other areas, and opened our eyes to the possibilities of other types of phenotypes, like, for example, that the virus might be upper respiratory and not spending its time in the lungs in quite the same way and so forth. And I think that the question of what a next variant might look like is extremely important and almost impossible to predict with any accuracy. But I do think we need to keep thinking about what the possibilities are. And I'm totally up for hoping for the best. And I do think we should plan for the worst. And in my head, worst here would be something that's very good at suppressing immunity and or something that's causes more severe disease in, well, especially the people that haven't got a good immune response, but could cause more severe disease in others as well. And I don't think those options are off the table.
Yeah. And that sort of goes back to whether the public health community can stay on this and the medical research community, that there's a certain amount of inevitable going back to normal among the general public, but it doesn't mean that everybody has to forget about this.
I would go back to my military analogy. At the end of the Second World War, large numbers of people were demobilized and went back to normal civilian life. And we still had a core of professional army who kept things going and kept practicing, kept developing new technologies, kept doing surveillance. And I would say that's been a net good for the country. And I think we're in that sort of setting at the moment. Now, we might get a big reminder of it in a few months' time when another variant comes along and is all back on the agenda. But I do worry. And I think the situation has also changed now, so that the settings in which Delta emerged were very different from the setting we now have. You know, Delta emerged in non-immune populations and tore through non-immune populations. So that's still possible in some parts of the world, but obviously in the wealthy world, that's not true anymore. And variants that will emerge will be ones that can deal with immunity, that can transmit better through people who have been vaccinated and seen Omicron. I think those things are something we really need to continue to consider.
You know, and I getting back to that point about not knowing why the waves go down, it seems like the scientific community has to be pretty careful not to get too wedded to its hand-waving hypotheses and really be honest with themselves and with the rest of us that there's this huge looming question. We were actually able to predict that our wave would turn around by doing wastewater surveillance and looking at what happened in South Africa, but it doesn't mean that anybody really understood why it turned around when it did and why the cases fell so rapidly.
And I think what would go a long way to making it less hand-wavy would be if we had quantitative data that showed why it went down first in this place and then in this place, and it's related to any of the things that you want to hypothesize caused it. So, for example, if you think it's to do with Omicron immunity building up in a population, show me the data that the Omicron immunity built up in the population to a certain level in one place that allowed it to drop down, and it took a long way further in another place before it dropped down because the immunity built up more slowly. Show us that sort of data. And then if that accords with the picture, then we could say, yeah, it's to do with Omicron immunity, or it's to do with vaccination rates, or it was to do with the way people introduced different types of measures, the success of the mask mandates or the school closures, or, you know, whatever your favorite hypothesis for a turnover is. People stop going to bars, people stop going to cocktail bars, restaurants, whatever your favorite hypothesis for the turnover is. Show us the quantitative data that matches the declines with changes in those things. And we've got that for other infectious agents. I've yet to see any of that for SARS-CoV-2.
And as we wound up our interview, I discovered that some people actually like the name of my podcast, Follow the Science.
The other thing I want to mention to you, I've heard you beating yourself up a bit about calling your podcast
Follow the Science.
And I've seen other people beating you up about it. And I also heard you talking to Stat News the other day about it. I have to say, I just want to be positive for it. I thought it was a brilliant name from the get-go.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And the way it's played out has got more and more brilliant, right? I mean, Follow the Science. What the hell is the science? What is the science? What are we following here? It's become, I took my hat off to you when you came up with that at the beginning, and I thought it was incredibly prescient, and it's got more and more prescient through time.
Well, thank you. I didn't think of it as beating myself up so much as just, you know, taking a look at how the public has used that expression in ways that were not always what I intended it to mean.
But don't you think that makes it even more prescient?
It does.
But also, I think it's been a very good lesson for everybody, including the scientists. Well, we had a lot of experts early on talking about herd immunity and body blasts, things that we don't talk about anymore. And the science has really taken us in very different directions from where we, the scientists, thought we would be, right? And the uncertainty with which we had to make decisions early on, there's some degree of certainty about some things now, but that's raised uncertainties about other things. To me, it's been a fascinating study in how science works and what it can and can't do. And so I think, you know, the Follow the Science thing is just, I wish I'd thought of it.
I'm still amazed and kind of horrified about what happened to those rabbits in Australia. But it looks like it's one of those lessons from history that we can learn from. Humans are always finding unintended consequences of our actions, and each countermeasure brings more unintended consequences. It also holds lessons for how viruses can evolve, and that includes SARS-CoV-2. I think that understanding its evolution is really the key to predicting its future and ours. And if we're lucky, it could help us devise better vaccines that could block not just the current iteration of the virus, but whatever it evolves into next.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That is FAYEFLAM. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman, with music by Kyle Imperator. If you liked today's episode, we'd really love it if you left us a positive rating and review wherever you listened. Thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.